Welcome to the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast, where we provide you sustainable training principles for strength and building muscle, effective nutrition practices for improving and maintaining a lean physique, and practical lifestyle habits for becoming a champion of your own health, both inside and out. Hosted by Aaron Straker and Brian Borstein. Welcome back to episode 2 of the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast. Today, what's cool is we have a little bit of a end of year 2020 Instagram Q&A. So we have some nice questions that some of our followers on Instagram sent into us that we're going to, you know, talk over, answer, so that, you know, you guys can have a really nice, just some good set of answers to questions moving into the new year about, you know, large kind of encompassing nutrition and fitness questions. But before we get into that, Brian, why don't you tell me a little bit around what's new with you with training, what's new with your nutrition, and a little bit of a year-end recap.
Yeah, totally. It's been a wild year, huh? I built a home gym. So that's the big takeaway for me. The biggest win of the year was a super dope home gym. And one of the things that I began doing also during quarantine was training twice a day, but basically with a once a day program. So essentially taking a big compound movement body part focus and putting that into the AM session. And then later on in the day, coming back after I've had some food and doing a PM session, essentially it's like 2 30-to-40-minute sessions instead of one, like maybe 90-minute session. And I've really, you know, enjoyed that and embraced it. And it's been so good for me. But throughout, I guess, the process of implementing this, you know, beginning in March, April and moving forward, it just became a lot. Like there's a lot of little things that I think kind of go into training twice a day that you don't exactly think about, in that you kind of have to get like mentally up for it twice a day. There's a little bit of like warm up and ramp up that needs to occur twice a day. You have to think about your nutrition a little bit more and how it's going to fit around your training. As well as, you know, you just need two different 30-to-40-minute time slots. And, you know, during quarantine with a wife and a kid, two kids and work and everything, you have to find two slots each day to train. So, it kind of reached a point where it just kind of began to feel like a lot. And, about 4 weeks ago, we cut my volume down. And, the intention was to go to one a day training, with the lower volume. And, it's about 25% less volume. It's not a huge cut, but like, you know, if we were doing 3 or 4 sets, we're now doing 2 or 3 sets. And, we also cut out a little bit of isolation work. So there's less kind of focus on arms and delts, but, I still, you know, interestingly enough, I still ended up splitting it into twice a day. So, just something about being able to put the intensity into each set and the focus and know that I only have, what is it, like 6, maybe 7 sets to do in each session instead of trying to fit 12 to 16 or 14 sets into a session. It just works for me. And it's one of the things that I think has been the best addition to my training over this last year. And to be where I am, you know, in training for 23 years and to still be able to find kind of new and innovative ways to implement training and make it fun and keep it fun and increase focus. And, it's been really cool. So, we cut my volume down, and what that did was, despite the fact that I'm still training twice a day, it drastically increased my motivation. And I don't know if I was never in the past as acutely aware of the way that I felt at different volumes of training. I kind of just was like, okay, this is what I'm doing, so I'm going to go do it. But now being like hyper aware of like, okay, I was doing 8 to 10 sets in the AM and 8 to 10 sets in the PM. And, you know, I wasn't super motivated. I was a little fatigued. And I didn't enjoy my training as much. And then to see it cut down to 6 or 7 sets in the AM and 6 or 7 sets in the PM, and just that small, subtle change, having renewed motivation, excitement to train, being able to continually see progress. And, that's where I sit with training. I can go into nutrition in a second if you have any thoughts on any of that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, especially because like, it's something you said, like, you've been training for, you know, 20 years now, and it's probably only been, or I don't want to say probably, perhaps only been the last like handful where you've gotten like very, very, very objective with like, okay, last week was this many reps at this weight, like these, you know, super, super detailed notes, and then being able to see those minor differences because of you're so, you know, objective with your tracking with it. So that is really interesting to see, and just kind of, you know, kind of taking a step back and noticing like, oh, wow, I feel better. I have more energy. My motivation to train is higher, because, you know, it's not like, you know, I mean, it happens with, I know it happens with me. I'm sure it happens with a lot of people. Like the sets and stuff you're doing, like the last two things of your workout are going to be generally, you're just less, I don't want to say motivated, but your focus isn't there anymore. You're fatigued. But when you're hitting everything super fresh, because your volume's down, right, your intensity can obviously go up. And mm-hmm. It's really cool to see that you're getting that kind of tangible, you know, feedback so early, in the approach to it.
Yeah, for sure. The point you brought up about, you know, being as kind of diagnostic with my training, I think is the right way of saying it. It really is only the last 3-4 years that I've really dug into the diagnosis and analyzed in such depth, all of the different training variables. So, it's weird to think that 16 of my 17 of my 22, 23 years training, I just kind of went into the gym and like broed out and just tried to win everything and, throw as much weight as possible on the bar, that I'm really, it's almost like I'm an intermediate in training in a certain way, even though I've achieved, you know, metrics that would be associated with an advanced trainee. So yeah, I guess going into nutrition, man, we're coming out of the holidays, and it's funny that you posted something on Instagram the other day that you're like, this is what happens when I stop tracking and you lost like 5 pounds.
Yeah, down 5 pounds in 4 days.
Right. And for me, I gain weight. So it's really funny how we're on opposite sides of the spectrum with that, because I actually think we're both kind of mesomorphic. You might be a little more ectomorphic, but we're neither of us are endomorphic. So I think we both definitely sit on that mesomorphic spectrum. And yet my propensity is to overeat when I'm not thinking about it, and yours is to undereat. But I guess it didn't help that we have family in town and that there's cookies and cakes and everything all around.
Yeah, for my nutrition with the holidays, so Jenny's family was in town, and, you know, for some of the listeners, I'm right now eating a lot to try and increase my body weight, build muscle. And it was just kind of, I needed a little break. I was just so, I mean, it consumed me eating, you know, 6-7 meals a day, if you include my intro workout. And it's just, it's a lot. Right. And I was just like, I'm just going to eat like a normal person over these, you know, like 4 days they're here, breakfast, lunch, dinner, like not eat anything bad, you know, necessarily. I don't want to use their, you know, bad, but like, I wasn't like, I'm going off plan and like binging or anything. I was like, I just want to have like normal meals and not be consumed by eating. And that's exactly what happened. I dropped, you know, 5 pounds over those 4 days, just eating breakfast, lunch, dinner. But I probably, you know, over each of those 3 days ended up at like a 12 to 1500 calorie deficit from where I was normally at, you know? So that's what happens when you have those massive, you know, acute kind of shifts. But, yeah, that's, you know, where nutrition is for me. For training, I'm recently started 3 days per week training lower body, having conversations with my coach, and he's like, listen, like, we got to get that lower body up. Like, you just don't need as much upper body volume. Like, we really need to hammer the legs. So I'm excited and nervous. It's an increase of like 30% more mental kind of focus and stuff to train legs a third day. I have to be even more dialed in with my recovery. So I'm like looking for like a local like body work or someone like that. Cause the initial concern is like, I got to keep my knees healthy enough to train legs 3 days per week. And we're modulating like volume and, you know, kind of some of the stuff's like lower volume, a little bit higher weight. Then I have another more like standard, you know, or more traditional hypertrophy day, but just, it's a big focus. So I'm excited because like, obviously, you know, you and I have had this conversation, like bringing my legs up to my upper body is definitely a big goal. It's been a goal. I'm finally making some headway on it. So I'm excited to kind of take it up a notch, but keeping my knees healthy is going to be, definitely, I think, like something that I'm going to need to prioritize in order to be able to handle that. I'm just like managing.
Do you, Have you started this yet, or did you just say you're about to start it?
I haven't hit the third day yet because I wasn't around on like the third day fell on like Christmas last week and, or sorry, the day after Christmas. And we were gone, to an island where there wasn't a gym. So I haven't done it yet. This week will be the first week of the third day.
Okay. Do you think there's a concern of overlapping soreness from session to session, given that you're increasing the frequency by like 50% basically?
Yeah. So how it's actually set up is the first lower day is like a power day. So it's a little bit like heavier weight, lower volume. I haven't gotten sore from that session yet. The second session is like a traditional hypertrophy one. And that one's like higher volume, right? Like some drop sets and stuff. That one, I actually haven't really gotten sore from that either. So, I mean, the one upside to eating, you know, 4,000 calories a day is your recovery capacity is really high. So, and how I've kind of structured it is I'm only taking one day off between the lower power and then the lower hypertrophy. But then I'm giving myself like two full days before after that. And that I think is the potential scenario I see where, you know, not being fully recovered is after that third day heading back into, the start of the cycle again, but I haven't actually gotten
And the
yet.
Third day is like a standard hypertrophy day.
Yeah. But it's short.
Yeah, I could see that
it's
as well.
It's only like three movements. And they're like super sets.
Yeah. I mean, I could see that working out fine.
Yeah.
And then especially if you like take care of whichever one, hamstring or quad, is the one that like tends to be sore longer for you, and making sure that that one maybe is deprioritized in the third session before the power
day
again.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Cool. Yeah. That's awesome. Business wise, the only real thing that I want to be working on right now, aside from what I'm already doing, is, kind of looking into some specialization cycles. And I was talking about having these ready for early 2021. So we'll see if I can get these out sometime in the early spring. But basically kind of like what you're doing with your legs. It's a really good segue in, because that is the general basis of kind of the design of a specialization cycle, would be kind of prioritizing frequency and volume on one or two body parts, and then dialing back the volume and intensity on kind of the remaining body parts. So you're just taking your legs, and it's just that whole lower region is now prioritized. And I'm sure that there's less frequency on the upper body, a little bit less volume, open up some of those recovery resources. And, that's kind of what I want to do. I want to do one for, I think I have one for arms, one for chest and back, one for hamstrings and glutes. And I feel like I think I did a shoulders shoulders and glutes, and then hamstrings and quads. But I'm working on those right now, and I think it's gonna be really cool. So looking forward to putting those out.
Yeah, I'm excited to see those when that comes out.
And then I know you have a big launch coming too, and so you tell everybody about that.
Yeah, so on January 11th, I'll start my next nutrition coaching education, and for the first time, training program, the Metabolic Performance Protocol. And that is basically just my take on kind of moving into a new space of the nutrition coaching landscape. So instead of the traditional kind of one-on-one, you know, periodic check-ins, I've kind of changed into a little bit more like interactive education-based as well. So I do a lot of teaching in terms of also doing your nutrition, also doing training. And then we have a lot of like group calls just to kind of change the experience. And it's been really awesome so far. So this will be the seventh iteration of it. So I'm super excited just to get started, especially the beginning of the year is always a really, really awesome time to start, because motivation is super, super high, as opposed to like different parts of the year. And just teach people, you know, as I call it, teach people or show people the cheat codes in making this really work, which is just, you know, a lot of the things we're going to talk about on this podcast of, you know, the tried and true methods, instead of looking for the shortcuts, the quick wins, but the things that actually, you know, produce tangible long-term results.
Yeah, totally. I think what you're doing is super unique, to be able to combine like a hands-on nutrition coaching with the education platform. So yep. Super cool. Yep.
Excited about it. All right. You ready to dig into some of these questions?
Let's do it. I think the first one's for you, or for you to start on. So this person is curious your thoughts on how maintenance calories should change when you're changing the sport that you're pursuing, such as CrossFit to bodybuilding, or more lifting focus to more endurance focus.
So What's really interesting here is I don't think they really, just because you're changing something, I don't think your nutrition is going to necessarily need to change immediately. What I would recommend instead doing is taking like a, give yourself a period, maybe let's say 14 to like 20 days, track changes in weight, track changes in recovery capacity, changes in hunger satiety cues, and then, you know, using like the three of those, kind of leverage that. So one thing that happens when people go from, let's say the first example, CrossFit to bodybuilding, and think, oh, I need to dramatically reduce my calories. But what they're not really taking into consideration, if you're moving into like an actual true like hypertrophy or bodybuilding training, like you're getting a lot more like muscular kind of damage as opposed to like the, like, you know, the CNS kind of stimulus or the, you know, cardiovascular output. And that has more kind of demand from a calorie perspective in like the days following as opposed to like immediate. So I wouldn't really change anything immediately. Let's say you're moving from like maybe a super high glycolytic thing like CrossFit to endurance. Maybe we go from a very, very high carbohydrate distribution to a little bit more of a balanced approach. Maybe we don't need as much protein, but I think if you're just like changing, I think it'd be much better to pay more attention to the signals your body is telling you and what you're picking up on, as opposed to letting the change itself dictate a shift in maintenance calories in terms of level and macronutrient allocation.
I love what you said about giving it some time to kind of feel it out, read the satiety signals, and kind of see what your body wants or craves from there. I do think there probably are some like not expectations, but things that you might expect to occur for like an average person. Specifically thinking like more on the extremes, right? Like CrossFit is kind of like this hybrid thing where you have like a little bit of bodybuilding and you have a little bit of endurance. And so you kind of just have to fuel it for like all these different ways. But like if someone's going from a straight up lifting game, like not even like metabolite style bodybuilding, but either call it like maybe like powerlifting bodybuilding or power building or something like that, where you're really not using a ton of carbohydrate. You lift some heavy weights, you set them down, you rest a little bit. You don't really ever get your heart rate up too high. And then you're like, you know what? I'm going to go train for this like 20K or something like that. I think we can expect at that point that you're going to need a shit ton more carbs, and things like that. So I think the context there, but, you know, without knowing you and knowing what your current state of nutrition is and what your body currently responds to, it's difficult to say how you might respond to some sort of different type of stimulus.
Yeah, I agree. I think covered that pretty good. The second question is a bit more, let's kick it to you to start. And this question is, what is the difference between upper, lower, and body part split programming?
Yeah. So the key to this is really frequency. I don't think there's magic in upper lower being better than body part split in any way, or full body being better than upper lower, or full body being better than body part split. I think the key is really just making sure that you're hitting what is the necessary frequency. So I talked about my own training in the beginning. And if you look at the way that a session is structured, so I have an AM session and I literally just dumbbell bench press and dumbbell fly. And I do like six sets of that. And that's my AM session. So you're like, I'm working chest. It's a body part split. Then my PM session, I have triceps and shoulders. So again, I'm doing like pushdowns and skull crushers. And then I'm doing some lateral raises. So I'm doing a session of triceps and shoulders. So that seems like a body part split too. Then the next day, you know, it's the same idea. It's some back exercises in the morning, and then it's biceps and delts again in the evening. Leg day, same way. I'm doing like a hip hinge and a squat pattern movement in the morning. And then in the afternoon, we're doing leg extensions, leg curls. So it's an isolation and compound split. Looking at that, it very much looks like a body part split routine. But because I run through that twice a week, it's actually like an upper lower split. This program came to existence out of an upper lower split. Like we designed an upper lower and we were like, okay, well now that's way too much fucking work to do in one session. So how can I split this up or lower split into something else so that I can get a little bit more out of each session? And that's how we ended up at this weird, crazy AM PM split thing that I'm doing now. But the frequency is still twice a week for every muscle group, four times for delts. So I think that that's really the key when you look at it. And maybe the bigger question is, what are the advantages of training with a higher frequency versus training with a split program or a body part split program? Meaning in a body part split program that maybe you're only training each muscle group once per week. And I think that this goes down an entirely different rabbit hole. So I know that you're going to have some thoughts on it too, but just to kind of continue real quick here, I think that ultimately science has shown that you want to train with at least a two times a week frequency per body part. It's shown a small advantage even going up to three times a week, and then all the way up to six times a week, it just kind of levels off. So like four, five, six, they're all just as good as three, which is just teeny bit better than two. And so as long as you're hitting them twice a week, that's really what we want. Here's the problem with training in a one body part per day, per week program. There appears to be really solid evidence that you can't do much more than about 10 sets for a body part in a session without causing so much damage that you're actually not creating any benefit from the additional sets that you're doing. That doesn't mean that you can't do 10 sets of chest three times a week if your maximum recoverable volume is 30 sets a week for chest. You just need to be really smart in the way that you implement frequency so that you can split your volume appropriately. And I think that that is going to be the biggest takeaway from this is how much volume do you actually need to do for a given body part? If you only need to do 10 sets per week for a body part, sure. I mean, I guess you could do all 10 in one session if you want, but I would ask the question, why wouldn't you want to do five in one session, get a few days break where you'll easily recover because it's just five sets, and then do five in another session? And the same thing can be extrapolated out with eight sets to eight sets or 10 sets to 10 sets. I mean, at some point you just get more out of it when you're not dead dog tired from doing five sets of pressing. And now you're asked to do five sets of flies. Why not do two sets of presses and two sets of flies? And, you know, a couple of days later, another two sets and two sets. So, I think that would be the main kind of takeaway from that. What are your thoughts?
Pretty much 100% agree. What I was going to add on to the end is I have found personally, you know, when trying to like really load up a lot of your volume into a single session, you kind of hit a point of diminishing returns. And this is something that like a lot of, like when you read some of your like, you know, whatever bro magazine splits where especially like leg stuff, where it's like, okay, four sets of 15 squats. Then we're going to do four sets of 15 like hack squats and like four sets of 15, you know, leg presses. Like by the time you get to those leg presses, like your legs are worthless and you're just going through the motions. And that's something like I definitely find with certain body parts, like arms, you know, especially like biceps, like I'll hit them hard for only like maybe like three or four sets per session. And after that, like they're kind of worthless. Like my output drops dramatically. And I know like I'm not, you know, if fresh, I can come in here and do the 40s and I'm using the 15s, like I'm not getting too much actual like true adaptation here because I'm just really, really fatigued. So I agree, yeah. You know, pretty much 100% with everything you said.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's pose this one to you. I work out hard and track macros. What else can I do to gain muscle?
This is a really interesting question because the first thing I want to talk about is work out hard. So let's pick it apart just a little bit. So work out hard, really open-ended, right? So because the goal here and the question is what else can I do to gain muscle? I think the first thing I would say is we want to optimize the style of training you're doing, right? Because your goal is to gain muscle, maybe, you know, running like a strong lifts, you know, 5x5 might not be the best approach, right? And just doing like squat, you know, deadlift and like pressing, it'd probably be more advantageous to maybe move into some more, maybe like a power building style if you really want to keep those primary movers in or moving to like, you know, more physique hypertrophy splits altogether. So with the first part of it, you know, I would first ask yourself, is the type of training I'm doing conducive to my goals? This was a big one for me personally when I got out of CrossFit. I really just didn't have any more CrossFit related goals. And I was like, well, why am I kind of doing this anymore? So that's the first big question to ask yourself. Next, I'm tracking macros. Are you tracking macros at maintenance? Are you at like a shallow maintenance? Are you eating in a surplus? There's a lot of considerations to make here to really make the get the most out of what your efforts you're doing. So with the macros, you want to be in a calorie surplus. It doesn't need to be some crazy calorie surplus where you're eating at like 30% over a true maintenance or anything like that, like the Dreamer Bulk type of idea. But it also doesn't, you don't want to be eating so little that one, you're at a diminished recovery capacity, or your weight isn't increasing at all. So like, let's say you're extrapolate, you know, a data set of over 4 weeks, has your weight increased at all? Have your lifts increased at all? If they haven't, you might want to, you know, take a step back and kind of reapproach it a little bit differently, increase your calories. I would probably, if I had to make a blanket statement, I would increase your carbohydrate. It's going to be probably the simplest, or the lowest hanging fruit in that regard. And change your training approach and make sure if it's not lining up with your goals. What are your thoughts on this one, Brian?
Yeah, I think working out hard and tracking macros is like the initial buy-in. It's like, great, you're doing awesome. You got started and you're doing kind of the big rocks. But if you want to get beyond just like the basic buy-in of doing a pretty good job and probably going to end up with a decent physique out of it, then it requires you to begin to manipulate a lot of different variables. You know, Aaron alluded to all of the training and nutrition stuff, but working out hard is great. Is your program smart? Does it align with your goals? Have you pushed the boundaries of recovery with your program? And if you did push the boundaries of recovery, did you hit it? Did you then increase your food and see if maybe you could push it a little bit further? You know, you don't have to dream or bulk for sure, but you do have to put in enough calories into your body that you support the process of muscle growth. You have to make sure that you aren't forcing progressive overload, but that the food that you're putting in your body is doing the job that it's supposed to do, and that each week your lifts are going up, or not even each week, but over the course of time, they're trending up. Let me see. I would also say that your workout program is probably fine if you're getting stronger and eating a bunch of food. A lot of different workout programs work. Like, I've had people, you know, that follow the Mike Mentzer HIIT philosophy, and they work out really, really, really hard, and they go to failure or past failure. And they crush it in the gym. And then there's people, they literally spend, you know, 30 minutes three times a week or something, but they work really, really hard. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have the people that are training 2 hours, 6 days a week, and maybe they're leaving four or five reps in reserve. And that also works. But all of it has to be supported by a surplus in nutrition. Beyond a certain level, you're just not going to gain muscle unless you're eating to support muscle growth. So I think that would be, you know, step number one is just making sure that you push those boundaries, that you push the boundaries of recovery, whether it's in the intensity that you implement in the gym or in the total volume of work that you're doing. And then when you hit that, you deload and you note where that boundary is. And then the next time through, eat more food and see if you can push through that boundary and get another week of quality training in before you have to deload again. Yeah, those are my thoughts.
Cool. Yeah. We're pretty much on the same page there, which is awesome. So let's kick this next one over to you first, because I have a little bit of different thoughts about how I'm going to approach it, but I'm interested in see what you have to say.
Okay.
So the question is, what kind of lifting to do if I don't want to add muscle until I lose weight?
It's okay. We had two questions that were about not wanting to gain muscle, and for some reason I thought we were going to do the other one, but we ended up doing this one. Okay, cool. Regardless, I think my answer doesn't change too much. So not gaining muscle is actually pretty easy if you're eating in a caloric deficit. If your objective is to lose weight and you're eating 500 to 1,000 calories below what is your maintenance calories, you really probably won't add muscle. I mean, you could train your ass off on a really intelligent program and you probably won't gain muscle unless you're a real beginner to weight training in general. I think it's a much more straightforward question when it's until I lose weight, because I feel like the other question that I was thinking about was more phrased as like, I would like to keep lifting weights, but I don't want to add muscle. So different question, slightly different answer. Maybe we can address that one, but let's get your thoughts on this one.
Yeah. So when I see this question, what immediately stands out to me is kind of a misunderstanding of how things work. So what I'm thinking when I see this is someone thinks, oh, I'm like bulky and I need less muscle so that, you know, my physique appears the way I want it to or whatever. But what it's probably is like your muscle isn't the problem. Like you just have some extra fat you need to lose or, you know, can lose so that you can get to that kind of physique. Adding muscle it's not like this trivial thing that's very simple to do. It's like blood, sweat, and tears to put on muscle. And it's not like you lift a couple weights and it just like jumps onto your body. Obviously, your goal is you want to lose weight. You need to be in a calorie deficit. You want to continue to lift in the same way that you would so that you can preserve the muscle you do have as you go through that calorie deficit. Because the worst thing in the world is you go through a calorie deficit and you lose like equal amounts of fat and muscle, and then you look the same way you do now, but you weigh less. That's like, you know, literally worst case scenario. What you want is to preserve as much of that muscle mass as you can while you lose disproportionately much higher amounts of fat than muscle. Everyone will lose a little bit of muscle when you diet, so that when you do reach that lower body fat percentage, you have that look, that appearance you want, where like your muscles, you can see more of your muscles because you have less body fat. So I think it's, to me, this seems like a little bit, this question comes from like a little bit of a misunderstanding of how things work. So you would lift in the same way. So to kind of like wrap it up, lift the same way, you know, you shouldn't, you know, neglect anything unless you have like maybe from playing a sport or a certain, you know, training style over a period of time became like really imbalanced, kind of like myself, right? My upper body like dwarfs my lower body. I think it would be just kind of, you want to continue to train in the way that you would, but so you can preserve the muscle you do have while you kind of peel the extra body fat off.
Yeah, I think the point you made about the maintenance of metabolism through the muscle mass is a huge point, because I feel like people forget about that. Like every pound of muscle that you have allows you to eat more food, which gives you more energy and keeps you healthier throughout the dieting process. Mm. So losing muscle is like losing gold. Like you don't want that. You had to work so hard to get that. Like, let's keep that shit. Let's do everything we can. So the other question that I was thinking of, and I get this question relatively often. So I just kind of a tangent related to this question. I get a question a lot. It's like, how would I train if I don't want to add muscle is kind of the idea. If I want to continue training hard, but I'm like happy, it's usually from females, but if I want to continue training hard because I love training, but I don't want to get any bigger. Right. So I think that that's where my head was going with this question, because I get it so often. And my answer to this is generally one of two ways. To do low reps without going into like what would be considered the hypertrophy zone. So something above, you know, 5-6 reps all the way up to like 30 is really gonna cause hypertrophy as long as you take sets close to failure. I think training a bit more like a power lifter or an Olympic lifter is a great way to be able to kind of maintain weight. And both of these are sports in which athletes have to maintain weight classes. So you see a lot of people in this sport that are small, and they're always small. They continue to get stronger, but they remain small. And that's because they're doing these sets of like 1 to 3 reps. They're not going to failure. Not like, I don't think that would matter with 1 to 3 reps, whether you're going to gain muscle or not. But I think that it matters because you're trying to execute perfect technique all the time. And your focus is in performing movement versus in trying to contract a muscle. So training with low reps, pursuing powerlifting, Olympic lifting type sport is a great way to kind of not gain. And then you also have to just make sure that you're not eating excessively. And that really is what covers it's the umbrella that covers all of it. Is no matter how you're training, even if you're training low rep Olympic lifting style or powerlifting style, if your nutrition is above your maintenance, you're going to gain weight and you're going to gain muscle probably. And if you're eating at maintenance calories or slightly below, then you're probably not going to gain muscle. So that's always my answer to that. And I think that there's some value in understanding that.
Yeah, I think you answered that one really well.
Thank you, sir. Next question is for you. Importance of protein timing throughout the day.
So I think the best way to answer this is there's levels, right? So there's some research on it, right, that we can use to answer this question. But I think the kind of creating an understanding of how you're kind of approaching your day will really help. So the most kind of the largest like accepted research I would say on it is there's, you know, around 4 to 5 protein feedings. Like I think 4 was where like after 4 was like kind of, you still got some improvement, but it was kind of getting into that diminishing returns type of thing of at least depending on your size. So let's say let's just speak to like maybe like a 165, 185 pound male, about like 30 to 40 grams of protein over those like 4 feedings. And the reason kind of that is the threshold is because of the leucine content. So once you get to kind of that range of protein, that leucine content is going to be high enough to kind of continue the muscle protein synthesis signal. So that, I think, if you're trying to set your sights on something, aiming for about 4 consistent feedings of, you know, that 30 to 40 gram range to help you kind of hit that threshold of that leucine content. What I think would make the most sense is, you know, if you have your protein goal kind of divided across that, or if you want to have like a snack or something like that. When I'm working with clients, I generally try and encourage everyone to eat 4 meals per day at the minimum. I don't really encourage people to go past that unless their schedule is conducive to it, but I think that kind of helps the best. What you really want to end up avoiding is like very, very large protein feedings all at once. So like, let's say you're only doing like, say you're 200 pound male, right? You're going to set your protein at 200 grams and you're going to have just do lunch and dinner and having 100 grams at lunch, 100 grams at dinner. And the real reason why you wouldn't want to approach that is protein is much harder to digest than your carbohydrate and fats. And it might just bog you down a little bit. So you might create some impaired digestion just by not necessarily the amount you're eating over the course of the day, but how you're splitting that up. So by kind of shoving it all in at once, you're just forcing your body to do, you know, your digestion to do a lot of work in that kind of acute standpoint. And that can kind of slow down your digestion and potentially kind of cause some issues in that regard. So in terms of the importance, it's not like the most important thing. Are there better approaches? Yes. Like obviously 2 feedings is better than 1. 3 is going to be better than 2. 4 is better than 3. Past 4, depending on who you talk to, you may find yourself in that point of diminishing returns, or we just don't have anything that's very concrete past 4 is going to be like, you know, provide tangible improvement in a shorter period of time or something like that. Anything you want to add to that, Brian?
I think you pretty much nailed all the points I was going to make. So I will offer some personal anecdote. From about 2012 to 2019, I was a big proponent of intermittent fasting. It was mostly a lifestyle decision in that I just didn't feel hungry in the morning and I enjoyed eating at night. But I will 100% say that eating 100 grams of protein twice a day is a lot of food to digest. It's a lot of food to go to sleep on. When you eat, you often drink water. And even if you don't drink a ton of water, there's water content in food. So then you find that you're up at night digesting and peeing and digesting and peeing. So there's some negative consequences there too. I switched off of intermittent fasting. It was difficult for me, but I did it slowly over the course of time. And once I finally felt confident with it, I ended up starting my diet that took me from 205 to 185. So it really is only in the last like maybe 6 to 8 months that I even have been moving away from intermittent fasting at all, began that transition. And since kind of going through that diet and implementing, you know, four times, sometimes five times a day, protein consumption into much smaller doses, I feel like it has improved recovery and digestion and just overall quality of life. Not eating breakfast all the time definitely is not the best way to live. So I think there's something to be said for that too.
Yeah. One little thing I'll add to that is so often we think of nutrition in terms of a one day window, and it's because it, you know, with how we work as humans, right? We go to sleep, we start a new day. It kind of makes sense to think of it that way, but that's not necessarily how our body, you know, works from a metabolic standpoint. Our bodies are continuously burning fat and carbohydrate and doing these things in like these micro cycles all throughout the day. So instead of thinking about it and just like, oh, well, as long as I get my 200 grams of protein in at before, you know, 10 p.m. when I go to sleep or whatever, it doesn't matter if I did it, you know, 10 times or whatever. So there, it does matter, but there has to be that kind of balance between what makes sense from your lifestyle or something like that as well. But yeah.
What are your thoughts on the approach that, you know, a lot of people do this now in the industry? I know Paul Carter does it, John Meadows does it, but like, you know, John Meadows is a proponent of 6 days of eating and then one day complete fasting. Paul does it where he goes 27 days each month, and then he has a 3-day fast, I think, at the end of each month. So, you know, now that we know that the body's constantly doing this and that you don't have to necessarily get protein in every day, but you know, you can make up for that through the other 27 days in the month, and you have then these 3 fasted days. What are your thoughts on all of that?
So I think it really comes back to what your goals are, right? I think for people who are like eating consistently, eating enough, the fasting can be a tool if it's something you want to use for like a, maybe like a mental fortitude type of thing, or sometimes just to take a break, kind of like what I spoke about with like my Christmas, you know, how I spent my Christmas. I was just happy to not have to be like a slave to putting food in my mouth all day long. So I think in that regard, it can be just kind of like a little bit of a reprieve. I'm sure there, you know, potentially could be some kind of small marginal benefits of, oh man, the word is escaping me right now.
Autophagy.
Yeah, autophagy. Exactly.
So, autophagy. Yeah.
in that, you know, kind of acute scenario. But again, I think that comes down to like what your goals are. But I know people who do it like just as kind of like a monthly kind of like goal kind of reset or just something to do. Or if you're having like maybe some really digestive issues or whatever, it's like a nice way to just let things calm down. So I think depending on what the goal or purpose you might use it for, it can definitely be beneficial within the appropriate context.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's actually pretty cool. I like the idea of it. Almost from like a just mental perseverance standpoint, you know, just like this is something that's not going to be comfortable, but I'm going to achieve it anyways.
Yeah. Or even like a work or brain performance type thing, right? I know mm-hmm. there's generally a link that people talk about there. So if you, let's say you wanted to have like a 19-hour work day and you didn't want to have to, you know, do anything, you can just fast and work all day. I'm sure there, you know, you might be the benefits you're going to outweigh with, you know, crushing your cortisol is probably going to be super high or something like that. Exactly. Sitting in front of your computer for 18 hours straight, but, you know, kind of balancing the ups and the downs there.
For sure. Next question is, what is your take on pre-workouts? Do you use them or nah?
So in terms of like your standard pre-workout that you might buy from GNC or online, you know, with like your Mega Pump X or, you know, all these silly names, I'm not a fan of them. I think they are largely superfluous. The main reason, I'm going to be honest, the main reason I don't like them is too much caffeine. So I have like a hard rule, no caffeine after noon. And that is even like, you know, like a cup of coffee. Like a lot of these pre-workouts, there's like 300 milligrams of caffeine in them. And then you take that at, let's say you're, you know, a standard 9-to-5er, you're going to the gym at 4:35 PM, you're taking 300 milligrams of caffeine. Caffeine has a half-life of 6 hours. So 6 hours later, half of that is still, you know, attached to your adenosine receptors. It's going to impact your sleep. And then it creates this kind of vicious cycle of like, oh man, like I'm dragging ass today. I need pre-workout, but you're dragging ass because you slept poor last night from the weekend, or sorry, from the pre-workout you took yesterday. So it kind of creates this vicious negative feedback loop. I think people think that like caffeine fuels workouts, right? What really fuels workouts is carbohydrate. If you want, like my take on pre-workout, I make sure I have a very large carbohydrate meal first, some sodium on that as well. Make sure I'm hydrated. And that is a fantastic pre-workout in itself. So there are some things like your, like some people will use like alpha GPC for focus with, pre-workout, or, you're like your beta alanine has like efficacy that's been studied. What is the other one?
L-citrulline,
right. But I mean, those are kind of like, you know, maybe that you get like one extra rep on that, you know, leg extension or something like that over time. Will that add up? Yeah. But I just think it's not, I don't think it's necessary across the board, but what I would, so no, I'm not a pre-workout person, a standard pre-workout.
Yeah. I take one with alpha GPC and L-citrulline. So yeah, I mean, I guess initially upon taking it, I did feel like it provided me some additional focus and I liked it. It was nice. It was smooth. And I've been taking it now for a few months and now I don't know if I really feel anything at all. I just kind of take it because it's like habit and I just mix it with my protein and it tastes really good. So, I'm probably, I don't know, maybe overpaying, but for whatever reason, I enjoy it, take it, and it helped initially, and now I'm a customer.
One thing I will add on that is if you are like buying a pre-workout, make sure that it's dosed appropriately for, or effectively, I guess I should say, for the things like beta-alanine and citrulline malate. So I believe the dosing on beta-alanine is around 2 grams, like 2 to 4 grams or something like that. And then the citrulline, I think is like 6, 5 or 6, where like the studies were done at those ranges. If your pre-workout's only giving you like, you know, half of that or half of each, you're probably look for a better pre-workout. So there are some that will only like, there are pre-workouts out there that will only contain like citrulline malate, beta alanine, like creatine, a lower caffeine, and like the alpha GPC, the actual like study things. So, those ones, if you do want to go that route, that is another approach too, but a lot of them are kind of largely just marketing hype and lots of caffeine.
Cool. Yeah, I would agree.
All right. I'll kick this next one over to you, Brian, to start us off.
Last question. Yeah.
And it is, Do you need to track macros to see results? RP gave me PTSD. I believe the context here for RP is Renaissance periodization and probably their templates, I would imagine, is where this question is stemming from.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, RP templates and diet app, a well-known company. Actually, Dr. Mike, you know, part of the squad there, he's been a huge influence in you know, a lot of my training and nutrition knowledge. So shout out to him. I will say with, you know, beyond that I have heard from people, I don't have personal experience with the templates or with the app, but I have heard that, they do take you down really, really low on diets. So with that said, I'm guessing that's kind of where this question came from. I don't think that you have to track macros that low. Like, you don't have to diet that hard. The thing with an app is that it doesn't know that you might have more time to diet. I don't know if maybe you put in like, hey, I need to be at this weight by this date, and then it starts, you know, doling out prescriptions for you. Or if you can actually manipulate that and you know, like, okay, I have, you know, 20 pounds to lose. I can't tell the app I want to lose that in 10 weeks. Maybe I need to tell the app I want to lose that in 25 weeks or something like that. So that's one consideration. But to the actual question as to whether you need to track macros, I 100% can say that I was addicted to tracking macros for 14 years. And over the last 5 or 6 years, I've tracked on and off. And I think that the 14 years of tracking diligently provided me with such an understanding of what I was putting in my body that it allows me to be successful without tracking now. I still have a structure in the way that I document the food that I put in my body. And I use a three-part model that has my body weight each morning, weighed under the same condition. It has a satiety rating from how I felt from my food the prior day, whether it's underfed, overfed, or satisfied. And then I also have how many grams of protein I consumed within whatever my brain determines that range to be, standard of error. So, following that structure, I feel good and I feel significantly less pressure day to day in worrying about the food that I put in my body. But I can't say with any confidence for sure that if I hadn't had all those years prior of tracking diligently, that I would be in the same position that I am right now. I think that the knowledge is the key. And when you can get to a point where you look at a steak or a piece of chicken or a piece of bread, and you know within 5 grams of any macronutrient exactly what's in there, then you probably don't need to track unless your goal is so beyond the range of just maintenance, right? Like, if I want to gain a little weight or lose a little weight, I can do that without tracking. But if I want to go stand on stage at 4% body fat, or I want to go get ballooned up to 250 pounds and make as much of it muscle as possible, an extreme goal requires an extreme response. And I think that tracking macros becomes a requirement of extreme behavior.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said, especially in the beginning, you know, back in like 2014, when I first started really paying attention to like my nutrition and macros, like RP was a great resource for me, especially Dr. Mike. He's still someone I always love to read what he's putting it out. One thing I will say within that is, within the context of this question, maybe they're using like the diet templates or potentially the app. When you use some sort of like automated pre-built system, there has to be constraints that are built into it. So it has to make the system, whatever that is, has to make assumptions. And that makes it can lead to different things with certain people, right? So I know, like, I remember the first diet templates from RP back in like 2014. And what I will say is there's like levels to tracking macros, right? The first RP diet templates kind of jumped you into like level 3 or level 4, where it was like, okay, we're timing each of our meals with these things. You need to have, you know, casein at night before bed. And like, it wasn't like step 1. It was like, you know, step 4. So in that terms, I could see if you were new to it, it could be like you're jumping into the deep end. So do you need to track macros to see results? No, I don't think you need to. But like you said, tracking macros helps inform you on what is in different types of foods and what these types of foods in certain quantities impact your body. So it kind of just gives you bigger margins because you know more of what you're doing. Kind of similar to what I really like always comparing the tracking macros to is tracking your finances. Do you need to track your finances to save money? Let's say you make $500,000 per year and like your house is paid off and you're just like, you know, buying groceries and hanging out. It's probably going to be pretty easy to save money under those, you know, circumstances. If you don't, if you have like maybe, you know, a mortgage and all these things and maybe your income isn't very, very high, if you want to save money, you need to create better margins. And you're going to do that by being more diligent with where, you know, the income and outcome is going. Very, very similar, you know, scenario can be tied back to your nutrition. When you know how much, you know, how, when like, if I put a, like, if I put a steak in front of you, it's like, let's say it's a top sirloin, it's cooked, and you can give me decent macros based on like, you know, Brian, like what you said with your history of tracking for so long, you now those things, like you just know it. You can create better margins. If you've never tracked your food or whatever, and I put a steak in front of you, and you're like, how much protein, fat, and carbohydrate is in that? And like, you're not even in the ballpark. It's going to be much harder because you just don't have that kind of that pre-built conditioning to lean on when you need to make decisions. So I guess to wrap that up, do you need to track macros? No, but tracking macros will help provide that foundational level of understanding so that you can create margins that allow you to be successful. The closer you get to a goal, the smaller those margins become. So let's say you want to lose 50 pounds. What you need to do to lose, you know, go from pound zero to pound one is a lot different than what you need to do to go from pound 49 to 50. So I think, you know, the context of where you are in your kind of journey and what you know and how confident you are in those decisions is what's ultimately going to really help you out in that regard.
That was super well said. I like that.
Cool.
That's it.
Yeah. So that was it from the Instagram Q&A. I think it was really cool. Especially like I said, heading into the new year, where nutrition and, you know, gym really becomes the focus for so many people. It was really cool to, you know, ask people what questions they actually do have heading into the new year. So we can provide, you know, hopefully some really tangible, context and things that people can implement to help set them off on the right path. Anything else you want to add, Brian?
No, that's it. I see we have a bunch more questions too, so we could come back and do another one of these in a couple months. So Definitely. Everyone stay tuned.
All right. All right. That is it from us. Have a good, happy new year, guys. And we will talk soon.
Later, y'all.
Thank you so much for listening to Eat, Train, Prosper. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe or share us with your friends. You can find more from Aaron at StrakerNutritionCo.com and more from Brian at evolvedtrainingsystems.com. Talk to you guys next time.